Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Jeffrey Archer's novels have always balanced suspense with insight into the corridors of power. From Cain and Abel to the Clifton Chronicles, he has chronicled ambition, betrayal, and redemption on an international scale. His newest thriller, Endgame, is swift, elegant, and full of moral complexity. In Endgame, Archer's recurring hero, Detective Chief Inspector William Warwick, faces his most dangerous mission yet, an assignment that leads him deep into the heart of political corruption and espionage, all while the Olympics are taking place. The novel moves from London's elite institutions to global flashpoints, weaving together personal sacrifice and public consequence. Drawing on his own experience in British politics and public life, Archer writes with an insider's ear for ambition and the limits of power. 300 million copies of his book sold, a member of the House of Lords, and now he slums with us. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jeffrey Archer back to The Book Show this week. Thank you so much for being with us. It's always a delight to talk to you.
Thank you, Joe, and it's lovely to be back.
What was it about this series? Once again, it's Detective Chief Inspector William Warwick, and you put this very wonderful character into the Olympic madness that took over London, and I'm interested in when that seed was planted.
Well, the series, as you'll remember, Joe, starts with Nothing Ventured, when William Warwick is a constable on the beat and takes you through 8 books, each one of them individual books, when you see him go up in rank to a sergeant, to a inspector, chief inspector, superintendent, chief superintendent. So when he reached the rank of commander, I looked at the year and his age, and it fitted in very neatly with him being in charge of security for the Olympic Games. Having been a runner myself, I flew over to Monaco and saw Sebastian Coe and said, I want my hero to be in charge of the security for the 2012 Olympics. And I'd like you to tell me what went wrong, because it was perceived by the world to be such a magnificent success. He said, well, I'm not the right person to ask, Jeffrey. You should talk to Commander Bob Broadhurst, who was actually the commander in charge. So I flew back to London, saw the commander, and wouldn't have been surprised if he'd said, I'm very sorry, I cannot talk about what went wrong. But 12 years had gone by, and he felt he could. And indeed, he's writing his own book. So he told me that 14 things had gone wrong. 12, not of great significance. I'll give you an example in a moment. But 2 would have been a disaster. 1 would have closed the opening ceremony, and 1, they'd have had to clear the stadium on the day the Bolt was running the 100 meters. But to give you an example of one which got into the press, the one that sort of got away, the women's football team match between North Korea and Colombia being played in Scotland. First round, when the North Korean team came out on the pitch, they played the South Korean national anthem, which caused some considerable unhappiness. And Sebastian Coe had to call them up and apologize. And in the end, North Korea won. It was quickly forgotten. But the ones that he did tell me that the public never found out about would not have been quickly forgotten. And they are all in the book, Endgame. And I put 7 of my own in. So there's 14 of the commanders, 7 of mine, 21 in all. You have to decide by the end of the book which actually happened and which were figments of my imagination.
Now, I tried to play this game, but the problem is you're so good at this. They all seem plausible, and that's what you want, obviously. They all seem like they absolutely could happen, and even the most ludicrous things could possibly happen, right?
Oh, yes. I think often when people have answered the questions at the back, the ones that look as if, well, they might have happened, people don't vote for them because they think they're too easy. No, you're quite right, Joe. You've got to think very carefully what did happen and what didn't. But the commander is the only, he gave me them, and he picked out the ones that he knew people like you would just love.
But I would assume from the history of these events that the London Olympics is really no different than any other Olympic Games, where there's a lot to worry about. Some of it's going to come to fruition, some of it's not. I mean, there is seldom such a greater event where the entire world is at your doorstep and in the spotlight.
Quite right, and a very shrewd comment. Because when I discussed it after the book came out, I discussed it again with Bob Broadhurst, and he said, "I'm so glad I'm not in charge of a future Olympic Games." And I said, "Well, what else could go wrong?" He said, "Try drones, Geoffrey. What will happen if drones arrive at the next Olympic Games and other things we haven't even considered?" No, when I was a child, Joe, many countries applied for the Olympics and spend a lot of money preparing to face the committee and try and get the games. It's now you're lucky if you've got two or three people wanting the games. And one of the reasons, as you rightly pointed out, is what they have to face if they're actually in charge of running an Olympic Games with over 200 countries, over 50 languages. And over 120 different sports.
I wanted to be at the meeting where somebody threw out the idea that we're going to take the Queen in a helicopter with James Bond and drop her into the Thames and bring her down to the Olympics. Now, obviously, that's a show, but that had to, just security-wise, even for what they did actually do, is pretty, well, for want of a better term, ballsy.
Spectacular. The arrival of a helicopter. I was in the stadium in the one of the guest seats, watching carefully. Over comes the helicopter. Mr. Bond is standing there. Her Majesty the Queen jumps out. They flash across to the royal box, and there she is. You're quite right. It was ridiculous at one level and absolutely magnificent at another.
In other words, there seems to be there are things that there's just the day-to-day games. You want all of the events to go off. You want the track events to go off. You want the swimming events to go off. You want everything to go off just the way it's supposed to. But then you have the spectacle of it that you also have to be aware that I would think would provide all kinds of security challenges.
Oh, yes, if you know that, for example, and now you mention that one, it comes into my mind. If you know that exactly 3:30, eight of the greatest sprinters on earth will be standing in one place and 10 billion people will be watching them, it must be tempting for any terrorist. And I talked to Bob about that, and he said, of course, we anticipated, and three quarters of the time, we were wasting our time sitting, twiddling our thumbs, drinking cups of coffee. And then you can get two major incidents happening within 20 minutes, and you've got to stop them happening. And the crowd must never know that they did happen.
Geoffrey Archer is our guest. The name of the new book is Endgame, and it is published by HarperCollins. I thought it was fascinating in the book because there's so many things that, as we've talked about, so many things that can go wrong. So then it's hard to know really who the bad guy is at any given time, and there are several, but it is this connection once again with Russia, right? Trying to figure out what they're up to and always knowing that that's a possibility.
Well, they knew a possibility at two levels. One, Russia were very distressed that the Americans didn't turn up for their games in Moscow, and the British, several British didn't. So they would have been angry with the British and would like to have got revenge. That was something Bob was well aware of and fully briefed me on. The second was the Chinese. No one denies that the Beijing Games were a magnificent triumph. They were a spectacle. They cost a vast amount of money compared with any games that had gone before, but they were a spectacle. And they wouldn't have wanted London to be perceived as successful, or even worse, more successful. So Bob was very aware that the Russians and the Chinese might not do anything, but he couldn't take that risk.
You have the book as really a countdown, and it is bringing us to the event, and that's what makes it so propulsive, right? I mean, because we're just racing to this f finale, which is the end of the games, that you got away with we're finally done with this event, and now we're on to the next thing that could go horribly wrong.
Yes, the closing event, of course, is usually simply nothing more than a rather nice parade of people who've finished, are looking forward to going home. But you've got the same problem. You've got 100,000 different people from different countries roaming around in the stadium or around it. You've got 80,000 in the stadium. You've got 1 billion people watching on television. Yes, it is one great hoopla, and they're all enjoying themselves unless something goes wrong.
Why, in your opinion, is Commander William Warwick the guy for the job?
Well, he's the hero, of course, of the book. I met a very remarkable policeman who was head of the murder squad in London, Commander Johnny Sutherland, who sadly retired when he broke down in front of his men in what he described in his own brilliant book as one murder too many. So I had him on my side and was able to talk to him, but I liked him so much and admired him so much that I based William Warwick on him. We worked together for 10 years. I listened to him over the years, telling me about his life in the police force. And so the answer to your question, Joe, he's based on a very remarkable man who was in charge of the murder squad.
And that really is always a possibility in the sense of that this, and how could it not, the job gets to you.
I'm afraid that's true. We don't understand on a day-to-day basis, and how could we possibly begin to understand what they go through, how close they sometimes come to death. I've had two remarkable policemen advising me. One, as I said, Johnny Sutherland, another, Michelle Roycroft, who was in the Arts and Antique Squad. So the books on stealing antiques and art were checked by her at every level. She went on to be the advisor to the British Museum. I mention that only because it shows the quality she brought to the research for the book, a truly remarkable woman. So I had these two remarkable former police officers guiding me so that I couldn't make the simple mistakes, but at the same time, they would come up with the most remarkable stories that they would never tell in real life. But as long as it was going into fiction, they felt safe to do so.
Tell us about Miles Faulkner.
Well, the problem with a villain, and villains are always the most exciting things in any book, and they're the easiest to write. The trouble, I wanted Miles Faulkner, and he right the way through the series, right up until the last book, he is a highly intelligent, civilized, well-educated man who could well have run a great company in the city of London, but decides to be a master criminal. And so William Warwick is chasing him right through the first seven books. And my editor said to me before I began the eighth book, "We need a proper ending for Miles Faulkner, Geoffrey. Don't let him escape easily." And so I went away thinking, "Oh my God, what am I going to do with him?" And then came up with, of course, what happens to Miles Faulkner and how he is responsible in the end for what happened at the closing ceremony. And no, I won't tell you anymore.
Well, let me ask about the art aspect of it. It brings us to a place that is quite fascinating of something that, again, seems quite plausible.
Well, I've been a collector, as you know, Joe, for 40 years, and love art, totally bonkers about it. And I always say to young writers, for heaven's sake, write about what you know about, and the reader will feel safe and at ease. So art has got into all my books. I can't resist it. So one of the books is about fraud and about collecting a major piece by Rubens, and how they collect, how they steal it, how they catch it back, the whole thing. And so that, with the help of Michelle Roycroft, who'd actually been through a similar experience, I put that particular one together. But I repeat, Joe, if you were to write a novel, you would have to talk about working on radio, working on television, being in the media, being in right. the center of the world, because the reader would say, wow, this guy knows what he's talking about.
Or are there temptations and things that you think about that this character has an opportunity, let's say, to have one of the great pieces of art in the world, his holy grail, if you will, and that in some way that you think to yourself, oh, well, that's interesting.
Well, you're talking about a major factor in the theft of what you call the Holy Grail. If you want to steal a picture, I would like to steal Caravaggio's Judas in the Garden. I think it's one of the greatest pictures I've ever seen, and I would love to have it hanging on my wall. But I would need to be confident no one would realize I'd stolen it, number one. And as I really can't see much purpose in it unless I put it on the wall and can see it every day, that's the next problem. If I was a criminal and wanted to sell it, almost impossible to sell a major work of art. The mafia in Italy used them as sort of tokens to pass among each other in place of money, but that's really not very successful. So the answer to your question is, well, you've seen recently, I'm sure you followed, the theft of the Napoleonic jewels
of
from
course.
The Louvre.
Yeah.
Well, they've already caught the people who did it. And frankly, the only way they were ever going to get away with it, and in that case, it was more interesting than just stealing a picture. They were intending to release each jewel from the Napoleonic crown, and they'd have sold the individual jewels. But my friends in the jewelry world, because I did a complete book on diamonds, tell me that the gems were so well known, someone would have said, wait a moment, that one comes from the Napoleonic crown. So even that wouldn't have been easy.
But in your novel, and I assume you touched on this in just the beginning of your answer, but that it, in this case, this would not have been stolen for any other reason than for personal enjoyment.
Yes, there are some people, and Miles Faulkner is one, who is a genuine art collector with a genuinely great collection. But were he to steal a complete masterpiece, he would have to hide it in a room that no one went to. He goes one better. He gets an ambassador, we will not mention the country, though it is mentioned in the book, to give him a major picture from one of the world's great galleries in return for what they intend to do at the Olympics. So I combined the police knowledge that had come from me, from my researchers, and my knowledge of art, and put the two together.
At what point did you know it was time to wrap up this particular series with this particular character?
Well, I'm 85 years old. next year, I will be in my 50th year. And I made a decision 6 years ago that when I finished the William Warwick's, there was only one book I wanted to write. I've wanted to write it for the last 6 years. I think it's bigger than Cain and Abel. And I think the story, without me, nothing to do with me, the story is bigger than Cain and Abel. And I've spent the last 6 years researching it and the last 2 years writing it. I'm on the 17th draft. It will be my final novel, Joe, for two reasons. One, as I said, by then I'll be 86. And two, I don't think I'll come across a story as big as this again in my life. And I won't want to follow that particular book. So my whole energy, heart and energy for the last 2 years, over 1,300 hours has already gone into the book, and I haven't yet finished it.
You sort of found yourself your own grand finale.
100% right. It's a risk, of course. The fact that I think it's the best thing I've ever done is not what really matters. In the end, Joe, as you well know, it's the public who decide, no one else. Yes, I don't think I've ever done anything better. Yes, I think it's better than Cain and Abel. But we will know because the public will tell you. And when Cain and Abel came out 40 years ago, I had no idea what was going to happen in those few weeks afterwards when it shot to number one all over the world and is now on its 142nd edition. I couldn't have dreamed that would be possible.
Now, the other thing that you just slipped into your answer, which I find staggering, is what, 17th draft. And now you are well known for draft after draft after draft. It shows your commitment to getting it right, to getting it to how you want it to be. But give us a sense of how that process works for you in this, even when you know you've got it right, that this is the one that nails it.
When you're down to one word a page, one sentence a chapter, which is what I am now, you're pretty well there. A lady asked me the other day, Joe, give me an example of a difference between the 16th draft and the 17th draft so I can see if I think it's worth it. And I said, well, there's a scene where an earl is being pushed down the stone steps of a wine cellar. And when he reaches the bottom step, the man who's pushed him down comes down to make sure he's dead, and he isn't. And he breaks his neck, disappears, makes sure he leaves the door open, makes sure he leaves the light on so no one can think it's a murder. They all think it's an accident. And then his wife comes down and sees the light on in the cellar, and she goes in the cellar. And in the 16th draft, Joe, I wrote the words, and when she went down the cellar steps, long before she reached the bottom step, she realized her husband was dead. In the 17th draft, I wrote, and before she got to the bottom step, she realized she was a widow.
Mm.
Very subtle difference, but so much better than the 16th draft.
And at that point, you look at it and say, okay, I'm going to let this breathe for a little while and then come back and look at it? Or is it a constant ongoing process?
It's a constant ongoing. I rise at 6 a.m. every morning. I've probably spent 2 hours awake going over. I mean, I got a word the other day, a jouster instead of competitor. And I had to find the page competitor was on, change the word competitor to jouster. It's never ending. My wife teases me and says, she'll never take me into a bookshop because she fears I'll go to my books and start changing a word on page 211. You've got to put the last book behind you. I was telling Mary over breakfast 2 days ago, I'm searching for a word, I'm searching for a word, I'm searching for a word. And it was the word rack, that you put a bottle not on a shelf, you put a bottle in a rack. And it hadn't come immediately. Other things were on my mind. It hadn't come immediately. But I got it in the middle of breakfast. So I had to run out of breakfast, find the page, move on the shelf and put in the rack. Yes, I'm slightly mad. You're quite right. I can see the look on your face.
No, I think...
I can see you think you're dealing with someone who's bonkers. I'm not sure you're not right.
No, I think it's amazing. Well, first of all, I love that you care that much about your own work and about the language. I think that is lovely that there is such a concern about not only just the story, but of the language.
Well, I'm quite happy, Joe, when you've read the final book to say, Jeffrey, it's not very good, because I know I can't do any better. What I would hate in answer to your question is to say, you're quite right, Joe, I should have done some more work on it.
When you look at this final novel, and as you're putting it together and finishing it up now, obviously Endgame is long in your rearview mirror, and yet that's the book we're talking about today. You have essentially moved on to the next project.
Yes, I think that is the case for every author. When they do an interview, probably when the book comes out, which is 9 months at least after they've handed it in, they're either in the process of thinking through the next book or physically writing it. And you have to concentrate tremendously. But I've found in interviews all around the world at the moment, the fascination is in the last novel. Yes, I can't grumble because the critics have decided that Endgame is a 4.6 and it sold in Britain. It sold 51,000 copies in the first 3 days. So I'm not, and I'm in 119 countries in 47 languages. So I can't complain, Joe. But just as you have done, there has been a fascination that next year will be my 50th year as a novelist, my last year writing a novel, and this will be the final one. So they realize this is the end. And that was taught to me by a man called Barry Humphreys, very fine comedian, who said, Jeffrey, when you are in any trouble or when you know it's the end, for God's sake, have a farewell tour. This is my farewell tour.
Dame Edna, a wonderful, wonderful performer.
Great lady and a great gentleman and a great friend.
Well, the new book is Endgame. It is out from HarperCollins, and it's absolutely delightful. It's such a great read, so much fun, and just doesn't let you go from the time you pick it up. Jeffrey Archer, it's such a thrill to talk to you. I wish you all the luck in the world, and I hope you'll join us so we can talk about the final book as well.
Of course I will, Joe. That will be a privilege to be back on your show.
Jeffrey Archer is the author of the new book, Endgame, published by HarperCollins. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.